Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Energy Series. Great CEOs and great entrepreneurs are generally straight talkers, and sometimes it's great for their business. Think of Jack Welch or Lee Iacocca. And it's always excellent for the TV viewer. This week, you're going to meet someone like that, Rick George, who is extremely eloquent, convincing, but who does not shy away from controversy. Rick George is in the energy industry. He built up Suncor, Canada's largest energy player. And all the questions you have coming to mind right now, well, we tried to throw a few at him. He has answers for that. Just listen, he's never boring. Here's Rick George. Rick George, you're known for some straight talk, sometimes very amusing, actually, and provocative, straight talk on the energy industry from the industry's point of view, and it has made you kind of an oracle or a lightning rod. Anyway, the number one spokesperson for that industry. How does it feel?
Well, you know, I think there are other great spokesmen as well. I think hopefully what I've been able to do is to show some balance as well in the discussion, because what you find about this energy world we live in is that there are people who are very entrenched in silos in their thinking about energy generally. And so you're right, I try to bring a little humor to it as well. But I think what you got to do is also take a little longer view and a wider view of how important energy is and how important relatively inexpensive energy is to the society we live in.
And I think I read somewhere where you explained in one of your presentations that we demonize oil very easily because it's easy to put the words dirty and oil together. Obviously, if you have if you drop a drop of oil on the carpet or on your pants, it's going to make a stain. But that's in its nature. It's like wet water. But people make that association and get away with it.
Well, you know, listen, I think the industry needs to do a much better job, and I'll take responsibility for part of that as well, in terms of getting out and telling our story about the importance of energy, oil, gas, other forms of energy as well, and get away from this labeling. And so I think what we need to do in our industry is get out and tell our story much better in a much clearer language that people understand.
And this is going to take time, I assume, because when something has been successfully demonized in the media, before the pendulum swings back, can take a while, and you practically have to push on it.
Well, sure, you got to work hard at it, and it's not going to be a job that's over at any one point in time. You're going to have to keep your messages up front. You're going to have to show real progression on the environmental front as far as reducing the amount of energy it takes to produce the energy we use by different forms of consumption. You got to work hard on reducing emissions of all types, and importantly, reduce your use of water, and your land reclamation has to speed up. So there's lots of jobs to do out there, which the industry's got a great track record of. We got to get out and talk about that more.
And still in the realm of demonization, you point out that tankers, oil tankers, are inherently more dangerous than pipelines, and that seems obvious. It's common sense. And yet, why do pipelines still strike people the wrong way?
Well, you know, I wouldn't say it's just pipelines. If you've looked about putting in major transmission lines for electricity, you get the same kind of reaction, and that is everybody knows that society needs energy in relatively cheap forms, and we got to move this stuff around this great country of ours, but around the continent as well. But, you know, everyone knows that intellectually. They understand it. They don't necessarily want it in their backyard, which is, again, part of the issue here, is that everyone needs to kind of think broadly about what's best for society, not just your own individual silo.
Do you do a slow burn, no pun intended, when you see that coal gets such an easy ride from the media and the activists? Coal is much more important in the energy picture in America than oil ever was, but it does get a free ride.
You know, the quote I often use is the whole entire Canadian oil sands industry produces less CO2 than does the state of Indiana producing electricity from coal. And of course, Indiana isn't even in the top five users of coal in the United States as far as states. And so, yeah, sure, those are important kind of dimensions so that people have some idea of the fact base and some dimension to what they're talking about. But you know what? Here's the way I view it is that all forms of energy production have certain pluses and certain minuses. You know, even wind power, for all its proponents, there's lots of people who don't want wind power in their backyard. Also, we do know there are both bat and bird kills associated with wind power. So the issue isn't that there are impacts. There are impacts from every bit of both our production and our consumption of energy. The issue is, how do we minimize that going forward, and how do we effectively use energy in the best ways we can?
Didn't you develop wind when you were at Suncor?
Absolutely. We had about six projects in three different provinces here in Canada in terms of wind power. And you know, I love the technology. I would just say that, again, there's no free lunch in terms of producing energy of any type.
And in fairness to the defenders of sustainable energy, renewable energy, those forms, wind, solar, geothermal, I suppose if they were economical and competitive, fully competitive, in the end, they would be preferable to fossil fuels for all kinds of reasons that are obvious. But nobody's ever found a way yet to make them economical.
Well, you know, most of those forms take heavy government subsidies to make them work. And I have a couple of comments about that I'd love to have you think about. And that is, first of all, high energy prices is terribly regressive in our society. It's the middle class and lower middle class who feel higher energy prices more than do the rest of society. And so you need to be very careful. It also impacts manufacturing, jobs, a lot of other issues here in North America. So, you know what, I'm kind of a proponent of all forms of energy, obviously cost being a big factor of that. And, you know, if you think about government subsidies, they rarely work long-term, and they rarely actually end up to be a benefit to society.
Fundamentally, though, it sounds like a technology problem. If some genius came up with solar power with a technology that was low-cost, he'd be unbeatable.
But sure, I mean, that's true of all forms of energy, right? I mean, what we're trying to do in the oil patch is produce gas and electricity from formations that we thought couldn't produce before. All of those systems are actually based on new technology. So new technology doesn't apply only to one form of energy production. It actually applies to all forms of energy production. And I would even say it overlaps even into clean burning coal technologies. That's what people are trying to do, is apply new technologies to make sure that they make a difference in their piece of energy production.
Let's look now at the ethical oil argument, that it's better for America to get its oil from a friendly neighbor to the north with rule of law and environmental laws and so forth than to have to endure Hugo Chavez or other 9/11s or just the general hostility of the Middle East. I would have thought that argument would, like, sweep the board, and yet in the media, I haven't seen that much echo of it. It has not had the kind of grip on the imagination you'd think it would.
Yeah, well, I do think it's a good, strong argument, but it's just one argument among many, right? And certainly, I can tell you this, as a Canadian, I'm very proud of the overall track record of this country on the environment, and I think we shouldn't be ashamed at that at all. If you think about how we've handled our coastlines, how we've handled our national parks, how much land we've set aside for society long term, we've done a great job. And those people that think or say that Canada hasn't done a great job actually, I think, are misleading people. I'm very proud of this country. We're actually, in our industry, more heavily regulated than the Americans are, for example. And so, you know, the thing is, it can't be just one pitch or one angle that gets this. I think we got to get out, talk about it, make sure people understand that Canadians stand for the environment. And we've got a track record that is the envy of any country in the world.
But it's not only that. If Americans were polled, I'm sure they would agree that Canada is a true friend and is an authentic democracy and all of those good things. But despite that, they don't seem to mind buying oil from all these crummy dictatorships.
Well, you know, I don't think they stop to think about it that much. I mean, you know what? The American society is based on a relatively cheap energy, which is not necessarily a bad thing. And I don't think they stop and think about where that gasoline or diesel that they put in their vehicle comes from, only on a rare occasion. In fact, if you ask the average American, where does their oil come from, where is it imported from, they'd probably say Saudi Arabia, right? Which, of course, is some of it comes from there, but not as much these days. In fact, very little these days.
You had some choice words, fun to read, although I can't repeat them here, about James Cameron, the director, who's, I believe, of Canadian origin, and he came up to the oil sands and he flew over in his private helicopter. That did not escape your attention. You had some fun with that.
Well, I was just trying to point out the hypocrisy of people who fly in on their private planes, make statements, and then fly back. I mean, the hypocrisy is, I actually have a better time with environmentalists and other leaders who live a life that they proclaim others should live. But for people to you know, have huge homes, a private helicopter, a private submarine, a private jet, and then come up and tell Canadians how they should live their life, I just find the hypocrisy pretty rich.
And you must crack a smile, a secret smile, when you think about that bestseller a few years ago about $200 oil and peak oil and the end of oil and all those things. And this was before fracking. And, of course, everything has changed, notably because of fracking. There's a lesson there about how quickly things can change and how unpredictable they are in this area.
Yeah, you know, this industry and the energy industry in general is full of cycles. And, you know, every cycle you go through, you think it's the end of all cycles. It's never like that. So, you know, we're enjoying now, obviously, a real abundance and increase in production in North America. It's great for our economies, both Canada and the U.S. It's great for employment. It's great for trade balances. It's actually been absolutely tremendous. But there'll be another cycle to this, you know, 3 to 4 to 10 years down the road. There always has been and there always will be.
I remember reading a statement of yours a few years back, which you made, I believe, as an engineer, not a climate scientist, but just as an observer. You were saying that given the extremes of heat and cold that this planet has endured and lived through the millennia, hard to believe that we alone by ourselves are making much of a difference at the surface of it. A lot of climate skeptics who used to say that are now coming around and are getting worried. Are you coming around, or are you still holding to your initial view?
Well, you know, I actually don't try to get overly engaged in the climate science debate. I am not a climate scientist, and I understand that. I think the job of our industry is to reduce emissions at every single turn point, and that's emissions both air, land, and water. And really, rather than focusing in on that debate over climate, because I think the story is still yet to be written, there's a lot of things that are unknown. But for our industry, focusing in on what we can control and what we can deliver in terms of positive change, that's what our focus should be.
You're originally from a small town called Brush, Colorado, a very pretty name. But I read somewhere you wanted to, of course, see the big city and sort of get out of there. And now you're in Alberta. Calgary is not a small town, but you've sort of come full circle.
Well, you know, first of all, I love the industry that I picked and I've been in it. I really actually started as a field laborer in eastern Colorado, went on to university with several degrees. And you know, I love the industry. I love the West. I love, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit of this industry and, of, to be honest with you, of Calgary. I find Calgary to be a very young people's town. It's a very entrepreneurial town with lots of opportunities for lots of people.
Now, we're going to make some friends and enemies all at once by stating a fact. You are sometimes called Mr. Oil Sands because you're the entrepreneur who had the vision to make a big bet on that originally. And it must have taken some guts, entrepreneurially speaking, because the outcome was far from certain. It worked, but the outcome was not certain at all.
Well, you know, no outcome is absolutely certain. I guess, you know, it was a calculated bet. We went with a Project Millennium, which in 1998 we started construction. And it was a $2.4 billion bet, which back then was a big bet for Suncor and for the industry. It ended up to be about $3.4 billion in total. So obviously it wasn't perfect. It actually has been the cheapest expansion of any oil sands project since that period of time. It was a big bet. It is part of what drove Suncor to be a $50 billion company and the largest energy company in this country. And so part of it is you got to have a real instinctive feel about your business, your industry. You got to know where you are in the cycle. And if you can do that and make the right kinds of bets with appropriate risk, you can get huge rewards as well.
But what led your instinct in that direction? Because all the experts were saying the opposite, that it was, you know, very iffy, would take a long, long time, lots of money, it was a sinkhole. Everybody was saying that. You didn't believe that. Why?
Well, I think it is a real belief in technology. I mean, one of the reasons I love this industry is the technologies that we use are evolving constantly. So everyone thinks of technology, they think of Google or they think of Apple and you know, coming out with a new iPhone every 6 weeks or every 2 months. This industry changes radically and very differently. It doesn't go in 6 month increments, but I can tell you that it changes rapidly. You only have to look at the last decade in terms of oil sands, but the whole tight oil, tight shale gas plays with fracking and horizontal drilling to know that this technology is changing rapidly and will change even more rapidly, I think, over the next decade.
Now, technology can make us leap forward, no doubt, but sometimes aren't there unseen downsides? I'm thinking here of fracking, for instance, which is developing like gangbusters because it seems so efficient and perfect solution for now. But are we going to discover 5 or 10 years down the road that we shouldn't have done that much of it that quickly?
Well, I think one of the misconceptions about fracking is, you know, this industry has actually been fracking wells in one form or another for 40 or 50 years. And so, again, nothing is without risk. But what we haven't been able to do until recently is both drill these very long horizontal wells and then frack over a long distance. That's what's really kind of very different about this technology. It isn't fracking itself, because we've been fracking wells for a long period of time without consequence. So, you know what, I'm not a person who can sit here and say, well, there's never going to be a consequence. But I think good operators, good regulation, and making sure we don't make mistakes, a very important part of the business.
Wouldn't the industry save itself a lot of aggravation if it kept fracking away from areas like suburbs or just heavily populated areas where, you know, water reservoirs can be contaminated and so forth, if it just stayed in the wilderness with all the proper ecological permissions and so on? Wouldn't that be a safer course?
Well, you know what, it's all very geologically dependent, both on where you can frack it, but also where the water reservoirs are. No one wants to see any water reservoirs contaminated. And it can be, this can be done in a very safe way, provided that the wells you drill are well-cased, you do the right jobs on the cement jobs around the well casings, and you do the right kinds of things. So I think it's very dependent. If you take a look at the U.S. in particular, North Dakota, Texas, they've more than welcomed this. There's been no damage that I know of, for sure, in those very broad areas of Eagle Ford or the Balkan plays. Again, these are places where the employment's important, the economics of it is very important, and, of course, the resources there to be developed.
But I think where people get more worried is in areas like Western New York State or Eastern Pennsylvania, heavily populated, that's where people start to get antsy and aggressive.
Absolutely. Again, that debate needs to go on in those locations. Because, you know, again, all politics are local, but all decisions around some of this and how you want your communities to be developed, those should be local issues, which people do have the right to debate as they go forward.
I can remember when that famous piece came out in National Geographic on the oil sands with all the horrible looking, with all the aerial photographs and the tailings ponds, and as they're called, and so on. And I remember talking to a geologist who said to me, this isn't fair. The tailings ponds are a tough nut to crack. We're working on it. But as for everything else, we actually leave a clean site. We do incredible things once we're done. We let that land be properly reclaimed by nature. So where does the industry stand now?
Well, the industry's made huge leaps and bounds on land reclamation of these tailings ponds over the last, particularly the last 5 to 8 years. So, you know, my former company, Suncor, has reclaimed its first pond. They're working on reclaiming other ponds. And those, when you've gone back and seen them replanted and reseeded, the wildlife moves right back in. It all works. I actually think the industry, and I'm talking about the industry in general, will actually go to a point here down the road where you don't actually have more than one tailings pond for each site, if that. You may be able to eventually get technology that will take you from a dry state when you mine it back to a dry state when you're done with the process. That's ultimately where the industry's got to go. It's just a matter of how soon can we get to that kind of a position.
Since you are so outspoken, you must have occasionally some real knock down, drag out confrontations with environmentalists. They must really try to corner you and give you the time of day.
Well, you know, I really haven't had huge problems with that. But part of it is, I think, because I spend a lot of time, even today, but certainly in the past, actually meeting with environmentalists and talking over these issues. And, you know, what would be surprising to many is that, first of all, I would sit down with a Greenpeace or a Sierra Club or other environmental players. And, of course, the meeting doesn't all go smooth. But we would agree on 90% of the issues in terms of the desire to change and the desire to have less impact on air, land, and water. I guess ultimately some of this is always about fundraising. It's always about they want to see big societal changes. And I do think society changes, but it probably happens in a more incremental position than many of those groups would say. But I think because I've always been open, I've always had a pretty kind of broad view of this, and I also met with the environmentalists regularly, I think that helped to make to mean that there wasn't quite as confrontational as many people might think.
And on a personal note, in the realm of or by analogy with rich folks coming up in a private airplane to fly over the oil sands and then burn up a lot of gas going back to denounce the oil sands, it has always struck me as odd that people who claim to love the First Nations don't want them to share. I mean, it's their choice. Don't want them to share in this boom and all this economic development. It's like they're in their beach house in Malibu, but they expect First Nations to live in a teepee.
Well, you know, it's a very broad issue that, you know, we should probably dedicate more than a show to. But what I would say is it's very important that the community, the First Nations people's communities thrive and that they have economic opportunity, jobs for their youth, and that education becomes a cornerstone of their future societies. We have examples of that. For example, Fort McKay in northern Alberta has really full employment. It's a society that's changed dramatically. There's actually millionaires that have made a lot of money. And that's because they had opportunity, right? And so these remote communities, what we need to do is to make sure they have those kinds of opportunities so that their youth, and I always think about this is, what does the 12-year-old Aboriginal living in a remote community, how does he see the opportunities? How does he see the world? And how do we present him with opportunities so that he can change and have a better life for him and his family?
And for someone like you, who built a $50 billion company, Suncor, getting together investors for $500 million in Novo might seem like a much smaller endeavor, but it's quite a chunk, actually, and I'm just wondering what you want to do with it.
Well, you know, we've obviously got some projects going on, and currently one of ours is, as you probably well know, recently took on the chairmanship of PennWest. My partner Jay Thornton is actually on the board as well. And so PennWest has been one of those companies that has underperformed the rest of industry. So we're working hard to see if we can help the new CEO who just came in terms of transforming that company. So that's some of the work that we would like to do, is to take underperforming companies and see if we can turn them around.
Well, Rick George, I knew you had great judgment when I read in the research that you eat at Fabio Centini's restaurant in Calgary. It's a great restaurant, but he's a great guy. He's from Montreal.
And,
and I hope you keep on going there, and I hope we meet up someday.
It's a great restaurant, and thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Rick George, and now here's something else coming up on The World Show.
We have exposed so many people to learning that there is entrepreneurship. You can build your own company. The people building these companies are human individuals. You can look at them. They're no smarter than you are. So when we have them in the classroom and they see 10 or 15 of these guys and they listen to all the stupid mistakes they've made and see that they've been successful, mm-hmm. What we're doing is exposing people to this. Now, who are the people and where are they? So we started in 88 with McGill was when we started, but we deal with 20-some different universities. They're all very different. It doesn't have to be universities. In fact, I think that people outside of universities may be a better way for us to promote or sell or entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. One little case, we have the high school here in Montreal, which is very well known, and they have a contest. The students build their own company. They start it. They take shares for $1 or $2, and then they auction them off, and they have the stock exchange. And I went over to see this one day, and the students came out of the other classes, and they descended, and this is Loyola, and it was one of the most moving things I've seen. That is a case in high schools. That may work in that school, and they're now doing it in 7 or 8 schools. So our trick is to try to get somebody doing something, and again, the key, you got to get a good guy. And you get a good guy, and that good guy is going to behave differently if he's in Nova Scotia or if he's in Montreal or he's in Bishops. So there is some pattern. We're getting people to think about something that otherwise they wouldn't have thought about or wouldn't have looked at.
Mm-hmm.
That's his point. We're exposing this world to a lot of people. Now, the big banks in Canada or the States aren't hiring the number of people they used to, nor are the big companies. So we need jobs for these people. Well, where are we going to get them? We're going to get them in small, innovative types of things and innovative types of companies and innovation and change. So if we can get people thinking this way, and it applies to the big companies too.
Rick George was our guest this week on the Energy Series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.